Welcome to episode 153 of Primary Care Update. I'm Kate Rowland, family physician and associate professor at Rush University.
I'm Gary Forenchik, a general internist and professor of medicine at Michigan State University.
Hi, I'm Henry Barry, a family physician and one of the original poets, creators of the content for Essential Evidence Plus. I'm just returning from a lot of travel. If you recall, at our last episode, I wanted to talk nothing about anything other than the eclipse. Well, two days after that, Kate and I were speaking at the Illinois Academy of Family Physicians Conference in Naperville. We had a really nice turnout, an interactive audience, and really had a good time. And Kate, thank you for that. Well, 2 days after returning from that, Terry, my wife, and I traveled to Athens, Georgia. We took a nice leisurely drive down so that I could play in a golf fundraiser with Mark and a large number of friends. This is a fundraiser to support something called Lucas's Fund. It's Lucas with a K, that provides funds to support families and parents of neonates who are in the neonatal intensive care unit. It was a great time and a great charity. And just having gotten back early yesterday evening, I am a bit whipped.
Great. So we should say, too, Mark is still on vacation. Put on some sunscreen, Mark. Hydrate well. We'll see you next time. So on this podcast, we highlight patient-oriented evidence that matters, or poems. If you want all of the poems, subscribe to Essential Evidence, where you get a poem a day, plus a great primary care reference with over 800 disease and symptom chapters and thousands of interactive decision support tools. Check it out at essentialevidenceplus.com. The opinions expressed on this podcast are those of the commentators, and this podcast does not represent medical advice or the endorsement of any product. For a nominal annual fee, you can receive CME credit from the Illinois Academy of Family Physicians just for listening. Just go to IAFP.com, click on the online IAFP education webpage, and find our podcast. This week, we will discuss gabapentinoids and the risk of severe COPD, rehab after an initial anterior shoulder dislocation, and cognitive enhancers for patients with Alzheimer's dementia. So usually Mark hands it off to me, but this week I'm just going to keep talking.
You can hand it to yourself.
Kate, take it away. It's awkward without those transitions. Get used to those. All right, so I do, as always, have the first article. I have an article where a bunch of researchers used an insurance database to identify more than 13,000 patients who had chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, COPD. They used a database based in Quebec. If you want to know if these patients are generalizable to your patients, figure out how much your patients are like those in Quebec. So they compared patients who were given either gabapentin or pregabalin. They mostly were given those to treat chronic neuropathic pain or other chronic pain conditions. They compared those patients to patients who did not have any kind of gabapentinoid prescriptions over a 20-year period. So the patients who had a gabapentinoid prescription were matched with non-users of gabapentinoids who also had COPD and an indication for a gabapentinoid. So they had an indication but did not receive a prescription. So compared with non-users, gabapentinoid users were found to have a significantly increased risk for either being hospitalized for COPD, having a diagnosis of COPD after starting treatment, or dying from a COPD exacerbation. The hazard ratio is 1.39, with a confidence interval of 1.29 to 1.50, so clearly statistically significant there. The increased risk was similar with either gabapentin or pregabalin, and it was also similar regardless of the indication for the gabapentinoid. So some folks use them for epilepsy, some for neuropathic pain, and some for other kinds of chronic pain disorders. The article made a couple of interesting points. First, this was my biggest question before I started reading this, was what led to this hypothesis? I learned while prepping this something that I did not know before. In 2019, the FDA added a warning to both gabapentin and pregabalin about this very topic. I just had never heard of it before. Based on pre-market or post-marketing data, the warning was that especially for older patients and especially for patients who use concurrent opioids, essentially the same thing, that it can cause respiratory depression or even respiratory arrest. That either kind of gabapentinoid can. I also learned that several studies have noted an increase in perioperative respiratory distress in patients using gabapentinoids, and that was what the investigator said was mostly the trigger for this investigation. The discussion secondarily raises the point that gabapentinoids are not actually particularly effective for many of the conditions they are prescribed for off-label. pregabalin has an indication for fibromyalgia, diabetic neuropathy, postherpetic neuropathy, but not for other kinds of chronic pain conditions. And the evidence is pretty mixed. I spent a little bit of time in a rabbit hole looking up the various kinds of evidence available for it. And it's, again, a little bit mixed. This is, as we talk about all the time, it's kind of a many tools in the toolbox kind of thing. But the bottom line here is use caution in patients with COPD or at risk for COPD who are taking gabapentin or pregabalin, and discontinue the med if the patient doesn't respond. So if the patient continues to have symptoms, or if the symptoms aren't controlled after you start the medication, give them a decent trial on it, that they really do have more harms and more specific harms than we have maybe been led to believe. Henry, what do you think about this one?
Thank you, Kate. So I think this raises for me maybe two major points. One is the importance of post-approval surveillance, that many of the unusual problems take years before they manifest, and we can't just rely on short-term clinical trials to tell us that the downstream harms of many of the things that we use. The second is is really related to your bottom line here, in that everything that we do in medicine involves a balance of benefits and harms. And you've already hit on some of the harms. And so the big question is, where are the benefits? And so, you know, I did do some rabbit hole checking as well, as you have too. You know, for low back pain with or without radiculopathy, the data on the gabapentinoids are that they don't appear to be effective for that. And a recent meta-analysis actually played up the excess harms over benefits. For peripheral neuropathy, whether it's diabetic or postherpetic neuralgia or other forms of peripheral neuropathy, this is where they probably work. I'm not sure that they work all that well in patients with fibromyalgia. And we certainly have recently done some studies on patients with vulvodynia or other forms of chronic pelvic pain where they clearly don't work. And so, you know, in terms of balance of benefits and harms, if there really are minimal benefits, then you really do need to question whether or not this stuff we should be using at all.
Gary?
Yeah, I got a couple of points. You know, I always have a hard time when they use hazard ratios. I understand that it's statistically significant, but, you know, it's a 39% increase. I don't know what that means in real numbers. Is that 1 in 1,000, 1 in 2,000, 1 in 3,000? So in some ways, I find the hazard ratio metric to be more challenging because I don't know what to do with it. I don't disagree with Henry. On the other hand, the other issue regarding both, I guess, treatment and side effects is dosing. And I don't know that they've actually looked at this with regards to dosing. And I mean, you know, particularly for gabapentin, I mean, you can go from 100 milligrams daily up to, you know, multiple hundreds of milligrams in divided doses in a given day. And I just would wonder whether or not this might be a dose-related phenomenon. If I'm not mistaken, this is a function of respiratory suppression and not some other pro-inflammatory effect of the lungs, which seems to be the case here. And I don't know about Chicago, but in Michigan, we have been asked, I think over the last couple of years, to be prescribing Neurontin, essentially, you know, gabapentin, and I think pregabalin as well, much like we prescribe opiates. I've got to go through the entire MAP system. I've got to go through, you know, so, you know, along with you, Kate, I don't know why they even thought about this, why this became an issue, but I think it's interesting. I just wish we had more quantitative data to help us make a more informed decision.
Yeah, actually, one of the things the article called for was essentially better data. So this was a retrospective trial. I think one of the reasons that we don't see the kind of quantitative data that you're looking for is because they essentially defined all of those numbers themselves. You know, they said here's who's in the study. We're gonna pull those. And if they had a more prospective study, we'd get those. But yeah, they're calling for exactly the same thing. And yeah, very much we have to do the whole dual authentication
thing. Yeah, I get that. And this was, I actually pulled this out also, did a little bit of a deep dive. This was conducted as a time conditional propensity score matched new user cohort study. Also new to me, Henry. I can't wrap my mind around that. you being the resident nerd.
Yeah. So I'm not going to go down deep into that rabbit hole, but there are, formulas that you can apply to hazard ratios and relative risks and odds ratios to estimate numbers needed to treat and numbers needed to harm. I don't like them because they typically come from cohort studies where the estimates are really biased and that can't address all of the other confounders, but they're at least a starting point, and you could certainly do that. These authors didn't, and I don't think the author of this poem tried to do those calculations for us.
They very much called for better data. All right, I think we've beaten that horse to death, but maybe there'll be more later. Maybe we'll find more to talk about. Gary, it is your week for the quiz.
I know, I did the quiz, so I was poking around in some recent articles, and I came across this one, which just published, I think, in the last week or so. Okay, so this is the question. I'm guessing most people haven't read this yet, but based upon a recent article entitled "The Effect of Isocaloric Time-Restricted Eating on Body Weight in Adults with Obesity," published in the Annals of Internal Medicine just within the last couple of weeks, the primary finding regarding time-restricted eating, think intermittent fasting basically, when compared to usual eating in adults with obesity in the context of stable caloric intake. So they had the exact same amount of calories. They just chunked them differently throughout the day. So that's the gist. So the question is, what was the primary finding? Is time-restricted eating significantly reduced body weight compared to usual eating patterns? Time-restricted eating and usual resulted in similar weight loss. Time-restricted eating significantly increased body weight, or UEP, usual eating, significantly reduced body weight compared to TRE, time-restricted eating. So the real question here is, does time-restricted eating matter independent of calories when your primary metric is weight loss? So we'll get to the answer later.
Wow. Henry, tell us about shoulder dislocations.
Sure. This is one of your favorite topics.
I love non-operative orthopedics.
You know, family physicians still do a lot of sports medicine. Many of are still working with local high school and junior high school teams as volunteers and the like. And so I do think it's relevant to many of our listeners. So this is an unblinded randomized trial of 350 adults who had their first time anterior dislocation, the most common variety. These were radiographically confirmed, and these were individuals who were not going to be undergoing surgery. So think largely uncomplicated. There was no humeral fracture or other complicating circumstances. These were relatively youngish people, average age of 45, two-thirds were men, and they were managed non-operatively in these orthopedic clinics, basically wore a sling. And they were randomized to a single physical therapy visit for advice, and they received tailored advice with an option for self-referral to physical therapy if they weren't improving. Or they were referred for a similar advice, but also a formal program of supervised physical therapy for up to 4 months. And the advice basically consisted of general education, progressive exercises, and exercise planning for self-management. They evaluated the participants at 6 weeks, 3 months, 6 months, 1 year later. Guess what? In terms of subsequent instability, arm or shoulder disability, or quality of life, there was no difference whatsoever. So this is a place where you've got an individual with an uncomplicated anterior dislocation, have an educational session with a physical therapist, and leave open the physical therapy. It's safe, it's cheap, and probably a lot more accessible for many of our participants.
I should qualify that I think it's very important, not operative orthopedics is, I just am not very good at it, which is why I'm very grateful to the many, many sports medicine colleagues who always answer my text messages. It's this normal. This is another one where I think if you had just said, if you had written the quiz and you said, you know, do patients with the first shoulder dislocation benefit from physical therapy? Of course, the answer is yes. It is interesting that, you know, one session is almost as much use as ongoing sessions. But in general, PT is almost always going to be the right answer.
So Henry, you used to be a sports med doc in your olden days.
Yeah.
Did you do a sports med fellowship? I'm trying to remember.
I did not. And that's okay. One of the reasons why once we had our sports medicine fellowship up and running and we hired people who knew what they were doing, I said, okay, it's time for me to stop doing this.
So this typically occurs, if I'm reading the stats correctly, in, you know, basically 18 to 30 year olds who are athletically active. So you would have seen this. Does this surprise you? I'm curious.
It does not surprise me, but you have to remember when I was working with teams, we had trainers who could work with the individuals and make sure that they had return to play criteria that they could apply. So a very different group of individuals, highly motivated and potentially high stakes. You know, I can remember a pole vaulter landing in the pit and missed the pit awkwardly and dislocated her shoulder. And you know, she actually had a little bit more going on, but it is a common problem in athletes.
It just seems to me that in a lot of orthopedic studies that we do, knees, hips, back, less is more.
And that's what the point that I think really this study really indicates is that simple stuff works really well for far and away most common injuries.
And in so much of medicine. All right, Gary, tell us about, I just love the expression cognitive enhancers.
Well, I think they wanted to differentiate them from the monoclonal antibodies, which Henry and Mark have gotten.
From the cognitive detractors.
Detractors, yes. Yeah. So anyways, of course, it's useful. Obviously, Henry, I'm sure you might have some comments because you guys have done that deep meta-analysis of these monoclonal antibodies. But this is looking at the older drugs. So cognitive enhancers are, quote, older, and they're really intended to improve function in patients with Alzheimer's dementia. There are three cholinesterase inhibitors, donepezil, which is Aricept, rivastigmine, which is Exelon, and galantamine, which is rasidine, and then there's the N-methyl-D-aspartate receptor antagonist, memantine, better known, at least from a trade name, is Namenda. So they can be either used alone or in combination. So what these authors did really was wanted to compare the efficacy and safety of these in patients with Alzheimer's disease. So this was a systematic review, but also interestingly included individual patient data, which I think strengthened some of the actual conclusions here. It was a meta-analysis that looked at 80 randomized controlled trials, more than half of which were in patients with mild to moderate Alzheimer's, and about one-eighth or so with patients who had moderate to severe Alzheimer's. They defined mild to moderate as a mini mental status exam score of 14 to 21 out of 30, and moderate to severe is 6 to 13. So that's pretty severe at least the way I look at the world. Interesting, 80 trials only had 21,000 adults. And for about 12 of them, they had the individual patient data. One of the things about the study, I'm not sure I understand why, they only looked at studies that were published before 2017. So we've got this whole perhaps 4 or 5 years where there may be some more data out there that for whatever reason they didn't include them. Their primary outcome, since it was quantitative, easily to measure and easy to understand, was the difference in the MMSE score, the mini mental status exam score. And they a priori defined a clinically important difference is 1.4 points. So just to be clear on that. So what did they find? They divided up into an overall analysis. They looked at studies with mild to moderate and then studies with moderate to severe. So I'm going to go through those individually. For the overall analysis, donepezil and donepezil plus memantine both had exceeded that minimally important clinically difference of 1.4 points. Donepezil was just above that at 1.41, and the combination of donepezil and memantine was 2.57. Again, that was the overall analysis. Then they said, well, what about those only with mild to moderate dementia? It turns out that donepezil had a higher difference in the mini mental status exam points of basically 1.7 points, and transdermal rivastigmine was 2.7 points. So that seemed to have a higher effectiveness with regards to that score. When they looked at moderate to severe dementia, donepezil plus memantine was the most effective at 2.49. So if you take a look at the entire study here, it appears that donepezil plus memantine seemed to, on average, have the greatest benefit with regards to improvement, regardless of overall mild or moderate severity. Now, in terms of harms, rivastigmine significantly worsened the MMSE scores for patients with moderate to severe dementia and also had the worst adverse event profile that was shared with donepezil. So long, you know, the most studies were only 24 weeks, so relatively short duration, have no idea what the MMSE means with regards to actual functioning and the like, or, and as you probably all know, that the effect of these drugs do not have a impact on the natural history of disease. So long story short, there's at least older data. I guess you want to consider anything earlier than 2017 as being older data, suggesting that you know, these cognitive enhancers do have an effect on the mean and male status examination. There you have it.
When you boil it down like that, it does seem kind of underwhelming. do you know, was it just because like it took them, you know, 7 years to actually do the analysis that they only included that older data? Like what was their rationale for that?
I wish I knew. I don't know.
Maybe I'll go back and read the article and find out.
Henry, yeah, so I'm going to have to do something. Yeah, I'm going to have to do that too, because this is a study I know a little bit, and I don't recall. So I'm going to have to do a little bit of digging up. So this was by Veronique and colleagues, and she has a really good research team. And over the years in the care of elders, if I've found a study that really was likely to change my practice, it was more likely to come from her group. This is not one of her best efforts, frankly. They did a lot of good stuff, but the question is, should she have? So 2/3 of the studies were at high risk of bias, and they only had access to the individual participant data on 15% of the population. So limited scope. Relatively poor quality studies. Now, the mini mental state examination is not a researchy kind of tool, but it's what we use as clinicians use. And so I like the fact that she did that. And I'm going to have to go digging probably into the appendices to see, because she has the individual patient level data, and she already knows that the minimum clinically important difference for the mini mental status examination is 1.4, and that's consistent across multiple studies. I would have liked to have also seen responder and non-responder data. So the alternative, as you mentioned, are the monoclonal antibodies, which frankly are really disappointing and have much more significant harms than what we see with the cognitive enhancers. And oh, by the way, the adverse effects were mainly with the oral rivastigmine, not so much with the transdermal variety. And now the follow-up to some of this with, does it do anything meaningful other than scores on a test, is that, and it's purely from cohort data, is that these cognitive enhancers have been associated with a lower likelihood of nursing home placements. So there are some other downstream things that suggest that these may, in fact, continue to be our foundational approach to managing patients with Alzheimer's disease.
They slightly extended your time at home, but maybe didn't affect that final outcome. Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah. Yeah, so I had a conversation with one of our with a gerontologist at the meeting in Chicago, and largely confirmed that this continues to be what most geriatricians are using. And the other part of this, the cognitive problem with this is that what we're looking at is slowing the rate of decline. It's not that we are making people better and restoring them back to normal. We are slowing the rate of decline, which is a really difficult concept for patients as well as for clinicians and researchers to communicate.
You know, most of these studies were only 24 weeks, right? So we're only talking about half a year. And there was a, you know, 1.4 to 2.5 difference in the MMSE. Granted, you know, that's just a proxy for perhaps improvement. But one wonders if 12 months, you know, if 18 months, 24 months, you know, what happens at that? Because, you know, the usual thinking for me is that these work for about 6 months and you don't want to pull the trigger too soon, because after that, you don't get the same degree of what do you want to call it? Decrement in degradation of memory. So.
Yeah, I think the few studies that, and I'm doing this from memory, so don't quote me on this, but is that they do kind of catch up over time, you know, that you don't have the benefit forever. So like Henry was saying, it really is just a delay in the natural progression, nothing long term. But still, you'll take it usually in that situation. So. All right, Gary, tell us the answer to the magic of weight loss. Today's the day.
Yeah, so I've been kind of interested in this time-restricted eating, this intermittent fast. A lot of patients are doing it. They're coming in. And, you know, first of all, I don't see any harm, you know, except for people get a little hungry. You know, I haven't seen any study that suggested people that are engaged in intermittent fasting have any downside. But, you know, what is the upside, I guess? And usually the easiest thing to measure is weight, right? You know, but there's some at least theoretical construct to suggest that people live longer if they, you know, restrict calories and those types of things. That's, of course, much more difficult to measure. So this study looked at 41 participants. So it was a very small study. Whose baseline weight was 100 kilograms. So these were pretty heavy people, mean age just south of 60. So, you know, middle age to older. They were only followed for 12 weeks. Again, a relatively short trial. But they compared time-restricted eating, where they consumed 80% of their calories within a 10-hour window, and almost all of them before 1 o'clock, versus usual eating between the two groups. So they can consume their calories, you know, whenever they wanted, basically, ad lib. The interesting part of this, and I think the important part of this is that they did a pretty rigorous methodology. They had a pretty rigorous methodology to assure that the groups had the same caloric intake. So the only difference that they were measuring was when they took their calories in. Now, they had a controlled feeding environment for these 12 weeks. Obviously, these people needed to work and leave. So they also gave them prepackaged food to eat off-site, basically, and also asked them to keep diaries. You know, if you slipped up, let us know, those types of things as well. So they had a reasonably rigorous way to assure that their isocaloric intake was equal between the two groups. What did it show? Both groups lost weight, 2.3 kilograms over 12 weeks. You know, that's, you know, basically, what, 7 or 8 pounds. There was no difference between the two groups. Okay. So it didn't matter. They also looked, as a secondary outcome, a whole bunch of measures of glycemic, measures, basically metabolic measures, and also noted that there was really no difference between the two groups. So it doesn't appear, and this is at least one of many studies that have been really well designed, randomized, relatively short term. We get that. That suggested that it was more calorie restriction than when you ate your calories drove weight loss and the like. So long story short, I don't see any downside. There was no downside listed in here. Both groups lost weight. If people feel better doing intermittent fasting, you know, why not? I mean, it is one of those things that I think is out there, but it probably is the calorie restriction and not so much when you eat the calories that matter.
The internet is littered with reasons why it's beneficial to your health. I mean, like the things that you can see on TikTok, which I know that neither of you will ever see because you're not on TikTok. But like, seriously, it's all.
I thought that was banned. Isn't TikTok banned?
Or not yet. Get on it while you can, man. But the like, really, it's all about like insulin levels and like, but like a lot of like really crazy pseudoscience. Like again, like I don't know that it's not true science or whatever, but like you said, the reason just seems to be like we eat less when we have less time to eat it in. And like you said, I think a lot of people like it because it's easy, you know, like you're not like entering things in an app or whatever. And yeah, I tend to agree. Like if people are like, nah, it's easy, I'm just going to stick with it. Sure. I have found a few downsides with people. They get really angry, like when they're hungry, cranky. When they're doing it. I've had a couple people who get migraines who say that they get more headaches. And so they kind of adjust like how they do it. And but yeah, generally speaking, I agree, like you said, tool in the toolbox, and if it works for folks, why not? Mm-hmm. But a lot of the like people who are like, no, it's scientifically based, like, I think, but there's now a couple of studies.
There are a lot of theoretical frameworks, you know, because worms and mice live longer if they eat fewer calories, right?
And there's a lot of mice stuff.
If you have a lot of pet worms and mice, and you want them around longer.
Just starve them. So yeah, well, I'll be curious to see. But I think it's interesting. I think the reason they did this study, under these very controlled conditions, was essentially to see like, is there, you know, do these mice and worm models, do they walk over to humans, or you know, is it about the timing, or is it about the calories? And so again, real world, it may just be easier, and so it may still be worth it.
And there was no mortality difference between the two groups
after 12 weeks. Crazy. In 41 people, I guess I'm glad to hear that. All right. Thanks, everyone, for listening today. Again, you can go to IAFP.com, click on the IAFP education webpage. The Illinois Academy of Family Physicians is accredited by the ACCME to provide CME for physicians for this podcast. For listening to us, you can get 0.5 AMA Category 1 credits. The IAFP adheres to the conflict of interest policy of the ACCME and the AMA. You can read our complete disclosures on their website. We hope you all have enjoyed our discussion today. Please tell your friends, and we'll talk to you soon with more primary care updates. Mark, have some frozen yogurt for us. We'll see you next time.